You're listening to TechNado.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the TechNado, the techiest of all NATOs out there on the interwebs. Thank you for joining us today, and don't forget we are sponsored by our wonderful sponsor, who is ACI Learning. You should check them out. It's a lot of fun. We do a lot of tech training there, and we'll get you trained up on all the skills you need. So definitely check that out. We do thank them for making this show possible and viewers like you for joining us today. That said, we got a wonderful TechNado. You'll notice I'm not Sophia. Nope, not her. We are similar in size and structure, but I know that could be confusing. I am not her. But today is a special, special day because she is gone. Obviously, I'm hosting, but I had to find someone else to fill in. It can't just be a one-man show, me raving like a madman into the sky, which would be fun for me, but probably not so much for you. So I scoured the internet. I found someone with the right credentials. The one, the only. He's climbed K2. He's run with wolves. It's Don Pizzette. Welcome back, Don Pizzette. How you doing, man?
Hey, Daniel, doing well. I like how you sugarcoated that story, because the real story is Daniel called me and said, "Hey, Don, would you come back on to TechNado?" And I said, "Not if Sophie's there." And he said, "Have I got the opportunity
yes,
for you?"
Yes. And stars aligned. Here we are. Now, Don, our viewers have missed you greatly. We hear it constantly in the comments. Where the hell is Don? And I'm like, he's changed the radiator. Where
That's
do
right.
you think he is?
Where you keep somebody?
Yeah. So, how's the radiator been for you?
It's good. You know, it's odd. Not many buildings in Florida have basements, and even those that do, it's even more rare to find one with a radiator. And yet, you guys have done it.
You know, we built it specially for you because we spare no expense for the capturing and captivity of Don Pizzette. That's
you know,
right.
It's funny, and I'll just go off on a tangent here. But
please do.
In Florida, it is very rare for a building to have a basement, right? Because you dig what, a foot and you hit water?
You're in the water table.
And so it's rare. But Daniel and I used to work at an insurance company.
I was going
to
ask you.
Where the entire IT department was literally underground.
under the ground. We were basically translucent beings, Morlocks. The time machine. Because we never saw the light of day at all. Yeah. There were no windows.
No windows.
At all. Because we're underground.
No, I had a window.
You did, but it was like a view window to the office.
To the help desk.
Don had this big picture window that looked out to the help desk area, and we had big printers, and then he just had blinds closed all the time, paper over everything.
I think it was probably put in like in the 70s when they had some totalitarian dictator running.
Yeah, it is time for your 15-minute break. You will do this. I actually heard from some of the people that worked there that their bosses were like that, they would come by, everybody, it's time for your break, and they would time it and go, it's time to go back. I'm like, wow.
There you go.
That's not fun.
IT's changed a lot.
A little
right?
bit.
Like, you know, because you used to have to wear suits.
Yeah.
Ties. They expected the printer repair technician to have a tie on.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird.
That's not a danger, right? Does he get hazard pay for that?
I wonder how many of them died that way.
Yeah, yeah. Another printer repairman choked to death as Epson.
Like in The Incredibles when they talk about capes.
Yeah. Right. Right. It just gets sucked into everything, and that's how you get killed.
No capes.
All right. Well, I guess we should probably do this whole article thing. We got this thing we like to call the rapid fire section. And today we're going to go through a bunch of really fun and cool articles. I got some tech articles because I knew Don was going to show up. Back when Don was a regular on the show, back when it was called the TechNado with Don Pizzette, we actually did tech stuff. I'm not a tech guy. I'm a security guy. So we kind of pushed that off as Don went away. But now that he's back, got a few tech articles to get to. So let's get to our first one. This one comes from Tom's Hardware. Let me get the old link going here. And it says, rising metal prices could mean more expensive laptops, PC parts, and other electronics in the near future. Yay. That's I'm just ecstatic about,
you know,
this, Don.
A lot of people don't realize how many precious metals are inside of the electronics that you buy. And weird metals like, you know, platinum and palladium and,
right.
and stuff like that that you don't normally
unobtainium.
And so that's why like so many people push for recycling e-waste.
Yeah.
Because like, hey, there's these precious metals in there.
Don't just stick them back in the ground.
But they're in such small quantities. You know, have you ever watched a video where they do like gold plating?
Yeah, sure.
And it takes like this minuscule amount of gold. Like the gold is floating in a liquid. You can't even see it.
Yeah.
And it just bonds
to
the item. It's weird.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's a ton of metal in there, but there is some, and it's essential. And so in order for them to continue building these components, if the price of gold goes up, if the price of copper goes up, they've got to pay for it. Now, This isn't just affecting computers, though. This is affecting everywhere. It's why you hear about so many catalytic converters being stolen.
Oh,
right,
man,
now.
I saw a video of a guy that people kept trying to steal his catalytic converters. And he had, you know, like a Ring camera or whatever that was catching them. And, you know, they would yell to the camera or whatever, and they would jump and run. Mm-hmm. So they decided to prank them when they came back because they kept coming back. So when they came back, they come running out like as zombies. And the dude is just like bailing as hard as he can. They're just come chasing after him. Like, this is how you keep people from coming after your catalytic converters. You threaten them with human consumption.
I remember a few years back, my parents were buying a house.
Yeah.
And
you were stealing their catalytic converters.
Well, so it was a house that had been vacant for a year or two. Mm. It was when the housing market had crashed.
Oh, yeah,
and so
yeah,
you could
yeah.
buy these houses that had been either never
basically
sold or turned in.
Foreclosed on, yeah.
And thieves had stolen all the copper piping off the air conditioner unit, the air handler outside.
Yep.
And I asked a police officer about that. I was like, why would they steal? Like, I know copper's worth something, but mm-hmm. why would they steal that? And he goes, well, you know, you'd be surprised how much meth you can buy with
yep.
a little bit of copper.
Yeah, fentanyl is cheap, which is the danger. Don't do drugs, kids. It's bad for you. And it makes you turn to a life of crime, stealing copper. Yeah, it says that the cost of copper, which was $5,000 per metric ton in 2020, now sits at $8,300. That's a bit of an increase there, Donald.
Yeah, you know, it's time to buy gold, right?
Isn't it? You're right. Yeah, I see the commercials all the time, right? Have you thought about getting precious metals?
Have you? I haven't done this, but have you seen where Costco is selling gold?
They are. No, I did not.
You can straight up go to Costco, and we don't have a Costco here in Gainesville. I think you guys do where you live, right?
We do not have one yet. There's one talk of one being built in the villages.
Well, you can straight up walk into a Costco and buy gold bars. They sell 1 ounce gold bars. And people are eating it up. Like, Costco has turned into one of the number one gold sellers in the U.S. Practically
it's
overnight.
Probably at a good price.
Well, they're trustworthy.
Yeah,
it's hard. Like, you don't want to just buy gold from the random pawn shop in town.
Yeah, he could be ripping you off for all you know.
Yep. Yeah, that was a episode of Pawn Stars once where this guy brought in a gold bar and they're like, "Yeah, we got to drill a hole in it."
Right.
And he was like, "Why? You're gonna ruin the bar."
No,
like,
I gotta see if the bar is solid.
If it's gold all the way through.
That's
yeah.
right. Yep. Yeah, yeah. Fool me once.
It might have been silver.
Shame on you. Fool me six times. So yeah, be on the lookout, kids. It's gonna get nasty out there when it comes to prices of your devices. Because the damn prices.
Explain that.
I did not. But right. It worked out really well. Fell down the stairs and landed on my feet on that one. But moving on, let's hit the next article we've got today because the hits just keep on coming. This one comes from Ars Technica. Apple will bring sideloading and other EU-mandated changes to iPadOS, right? No, I'm sorry. That's not iPadOS. That's iPadOS this fall. This is an interesting change that they're making, Don, because correct me if I'm wrong, because security guy, right? Like, one of the big pros to having Apple ecosphere is that you have all this, like, gatekeeping and walled gardens that they do. Sideloading isn't a thing. You got to go to the App Store, and now they're opening this up.
This is a tough one. On one hand, you can make the argument that Apple is trying to create a more secure environment
right.
by checking the apps, ensuring they're safe, and giving you a safe place to go and purchase apps. On the other hand, they're like the skeeziest business on the planet, and they're trying to squeeze every penny out of people, and you don't feel bad about everything.
Yeah. When your iPhone falls apart after 2 years, like...
Yep.
And, on schedule.
And they're doing everything they can to make it where you can't fix it. And, it's hard to feel bad for a company like that.
Oh, I got a MacBook Pro and the battery blew up on me. Mm. And I'm like, great. This is going to be fun to replace.
Yep. Yeah. It'll definitely be cheap.
I'm sure it will. Cost me nothing.
So, you know, the EU had their ruling a few months ago about how Apple's walled garden is anti-competitive and they have to open up the iPhone to support third-party marketplaces.
Yeah.
Right? So the Epic App Store or whatever, you know, can now be available on the iPhone. Well, Apple is doing everything in their power to resist this, to do the absolute bare minimum of the EU mandate. And so the EU mandate was focused on the iPhone. And Apple said, well, the iPhone runs iOS, the iPhone operating system, but the iPad runs iPadOS.
Which, correct me if I'm wrong, is like virtually no differences
almost
in
the
these
same.
Operating systems.
Almost yes. the same, yeah. In fact, the only real difference is in some of the USB device support. The iPad's a little more friendly. Like, you can hook most USB printers up
stuff,
to it.
Right. Whereas, right, the phone is like, whoa, you're hooking something up there, buddy.
Yep.
You sure about that?
The phone's a little more strict on the MFI, the made-for iPhone restrictions. Also, the large screen and multitasking support on the iPad is largely not available on the iPhone. So I think Apple really defines multitasking as the true difference. But it's the same OS.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
They get the same version number. They get updates at the same time. It's effectively the same OS. But Apple said, hey, it's different. And so the EU had to do another ruling to say, no, it's not. and the iPad OS is a gatekeeper, just like the iPhone OS. And so now they've got to support it there. So this is going to keep happening. Apple's pushing the limits with the Epic App Store. Epic was when the EU mandate passed, the Epic was like, all right, great, we've got our App Store ready, let's get it thrown over. And Apple suspended their developer account within just a couple of weeks, and they had to petition that and say, mom, you're not playing by the rules. And they weren't.
Yeah.
so we'll
but nobody
see.
Likes a snitch.
yep. So
what is so obviously, like, what is the European Union's I don't know, what's their motivation for allowing, like, what do they care what Apple does as far as their App Store goes? Why are they trying to make them, or not trying to, but forcing them to open up to these third-party apps?
So there's a public reason, and then there's a private reason, right?
Okay.
So the public reason, the reason they're telling all of us, is that it's anti-competitive, that no other App Store could launch and compete with Apple because Apple won't allow it.
Yeah.
And Apple controls the majority of the mobile phone market. And they've effectively locked everyone else out of that majority. So they've locked it in, and they're doing things like Google's a little easier to explain. Where Google's paying like $20 billion a year to be the default search engine in Safari.
Yeah,
Apple's
like
doing some of the same stuff, right? So when Verizon, or over in the EU, it would be like Orange or O2 or whatever, all the various cell phone companies over in Europe, when they want to sell iPhones, they have to pay a huge premium to Apple to sell an iPhone versus the premium they pay for Android phones and things of that nature.
Yeah, yeah.
So the public side is that it's just anti-competitive, right? But there is a private piece that they don't talk about, but is something that security researchers are aware of, which is by Apple locking the App Store the way they have, it's put it in control of a United States company, right? Mm. And what are we doing with TikTok right now?
Right.
We're saying TikTok is China controlled.
Right. And they're an adversarial country. Yeah.
And but I mean, even if they're doing nothing today, tomorrow they could
go crazy.
Right?
Yeah.
And the same goes for the United States, right? So we might not be doing anything today, but tomorrow we could.
That's right.
And so in the EU, they want to be able to have European-based app stores that sell apps written by European developers that give money to European employees, right? And I don't blame them for that.
I totally get that, yes.
I would call it national security, except they're a European economic union.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you
how
call
that works
that,
out. But
it makes sense.
Yeah,
right?
Totally get it. I knew having Don back on was going to be a good idea. He knows all these things, right? So much fun. All right, let's move on to the next article here. Another one from Ars Technica, if I can click on it. It is Wear OS has a big comeback, and it is continuing. Might hit half of Apple Watch sales. I've picked this specifically for Mr. Pizzette because I know he loves this kind of stuff. So Wear OS, I thought that was kind of like, just some janky side project to somebody's that started to go the way of the dodo, but now the dodo's been breeding.
Sort of. You have to remember how pitiful this market is. Remember 10 years ago when wearable tech was like
the cool thing?
Like AI is today.
Right.
Everybody's talking about generative AI and ChatGPT, and we have to have AI in everything. And we're getting these crap gadgets, the rabbit AI.
It's,
a,
it's,
or,
a, it's the race to the bottom, right?
What's the one that pins on your shirt? Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen that one.
It's a little pin, and you can talk to it. A voice interface with ChatGPT.
I have not seen this at all.
And if it needs to show you text, you can hold your hand up. It's got a projector.
Are you kidding me? Okay, interesting.
Sounds neat. It's a piece of junk.
Well, don't sugarcoat it, Don. Tell us how you really feel.
So wearable technology has not weathered the storm very well, right? The Apple Watch, when it came out, many people considered it a game changer. It was a whole computer on your wrist. I mean, hell, I'm wearing one right now.
I'm wearing one right now, yeah.
But the Apple Watch today is very different than the Apple Watch in its first year, right? Mm. App developers were scrambling. We got to create apps that'll run right on your watch. And then they realized that like apps on the watch are worse than apps on a Palm Pilot. You know, like the Palm Pilot gave you more screen real estate, memory. And all that. And so within a 2-year period, apps on the watch dried up. And so now the Apple Watch is really only good for calendar and fitness apps.
Mm.
And if you know me, I use it for the calendar. So, so I like that I can look at my watch and actually see what my next meeting
is.
You
don't make phone calls on your watch?
I don't. Yeah. I don't. Yeah, I don't use any of that other stuff. But fitness is really where it's picked up.
Sure.
So Wear OS was already in second place. And second place of a crappy market is not a great place.
It's definitely the first loser.
And so even the article, I mean, they sort of acknowledge it like, wow, Watch OS is really jumping up. It's got 25% of, oh, wait, hang on. I'm getting my market.
Of a garbage market.
So Apple's Watch OS last year had 53% of the market. Now they're down to 49%, right? So Apple still controls half the market. Wear OS went from 21 to 27. So they stole that market share. So that's good. But it's still just 27%.
Of like $47.
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine Wear OS users can be counted in the tens of thousands.
Okay. Yeah.
Probably. I mean,
that makes sense.
We're talking, not as bad as Apple's Visor, whatever that was called. Not as bad as that.
Yeah.
But pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and they it says that they kind of partnered with Samsung. And another company, I don't remember which one it is. It was Samsung and someone else. Sorry. But that this is supposed to kind of help them pick up some more steam and start to really become a real market competitor with the Apple Watch.
Yeah. Samsung was really on board with Wear OS in the early days. But then Google did what Google does, which is they dump a ton of money into a product for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then nothing. And then it just stops. No more development. No more development for 3 years. And then all of a sudden they come back and they say, wait, this is the greatest thing. We're putting money into it again. They've done that with Android. They've done it with Gmail. They've done it with all their products. You take the most expensive products Google sells, they've done this, where they will stagnate for years. And so Samsung at one point said, hey, if you guys aren't going to keep developing Wear OS, we're going to switch to our own thing. And they started to create their own operating system. And I can't remember what it was called, but it was designed not just to run on the Apple Watch, their watch, but also tablets and other things. And they were like, we're just going to push Android out if you guys aren't going to keep developing it, because Samsung really is propping up the Android market.
Yeah.
But now that Google's put some more investment into it, Samsung's back on board, and that's a game changer. That's going to keep Wear OS alive.
Well, I know I'm going to go buy me some Wear OS. That's all I know. I'm gonna have six Wear OS watches. I'm going to have one on my ankle. Just go buck wild with it. All right, moving on. We're done with that. Well, there was your tech news.
There you go.
There you go. Don, I'm so glad to have you back. We get to talk about Wear OS once again. That said, we're moving on to a little more of the security side of things when it comes to our rapid fire. And today, this article comes from Dark Reading, DPRK's Kim. I'm going to call him Kim Sucky because they suck. Their APT abuses weak DMARC policies. The feds warn organizations can go a long way toward preventing spoofing attacks by changing one basic parameter in their DNS settings. Oh, Don. Now, last time I checked, DMARC was meant to help us, not be a vulnerability.
All right. So I'm torn on this article, Daniel, because on one hand, I view it as sensationalism.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they're technically right. There is one setting in DMARC that if you have it set incorrectly, makes it where DMARC is
basically useless. Actually, not even just useless. It actually works against you, because now it seems like it's coming from an authorized center, because that's what DMARC does. It says, this came from the authorized domain. You are good.
Yep.
Uh-oh. It didn't come from the authorized domain, by the way.
So over the last couple of years, major email providers like Office 365, Microsoft 365, Google did it with G Suite, SendGrid, Mailgun, like all these big, the people who send the most email, reached out to all their customers and said, look, if you want to keep sending email through our systems, you've got to set up DMARC. And so people scrambled to get it set up, and DMARC adoption has gone up significantly in just the last 3 years. But the problem is, if you ever worked with these records, think of like SPF, right?
The Sender Policy Framework.
Right. Where you basically, with an SPF record, you put it in DNS, it's text, and you say, here's the servers that are allowed to send email from my domain.
That's right.
If you get email from my domain from a different server, not me, throw it out.
Yep.
Okay. But it was just based on IPs. And the problem was DNS records can be spoofed, can be overridden, and so they ran into challenges with it. And so DMARC was kind of the successor for that, and it created another way for you to provide it using digital signatures. So it was a much more secure method, much more difficult to spoof or poison. The problem is when you implement it, there's little attributes that you have to set, and one of them is the policy attribute. And the policy attribute says, if you get an email not from my list, what do you do with it? And there's three options. One option is you reject it.
Yeah.
Hey, this isn't a good email. I'm going to reject it. The other option is you quarantine it. And that seems like a no-brainer, except not everybody has an email quarantine. So that may or may not work. And then the third option is do nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Just send the email.
So if it's P equals none, that means do nothing. Now, why would you have a setting like that? The intention of P equals none was when you implement a DMARC policy, you turn that on. And you monitor your log. You set up an RUA. It's a where it sends an email.
Hold on, Don. That sounds like work. We can have that.
It is.
I gotta go and make setting changes. That's some horseshit right there.
It's like, have you ever configured an outbound firewall?
Sure. Yeah, I probably have from time to time.
So
not lately.
Tons of people do inbound firewalls, right? Filter the traffic as it comes in.
But outbound is much more difficult.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the way to do it, and this is the same with IPS and IDS devices and stuff like that, is you turn them on, but you don't let them enforce.
Right.
You just say log everything that would have been flagged. And then you go through the logs and you identify the good stuff and you create the appropriate rules. And you keep doing that over and over. It might take weeks or months. They call it training the firewall. And until you get to a point where your logs are just full of crap that you wanted to block, right? And that's how DMARC is supposed to be. You're supposed to go in, evaluate everything, find all the servers that you forgot about because they're all over.
I thought this was Ron Popeil, man. Set it and forget it, right? I turned the DMARC on. I did the right thing.
That's what people do.
Yes.
They turn on DMARC, they leave that policy set to none, and they never come back.
Yep. They're like, yeah, this was fun. I like this game. I got to. Well, and this just goes to show you like why we still have problems with security a lot of times is that we feel like we purchased the thing, I turned the key on. It's a little security engine. It's doing the security engine stuff, right? Well, yeah, but much like a F1 racer or something like that, it's those fine tunings that we have to really dig into and find those settings. And it takes work. You're going to have to sit around and kind of monitor these things and make sure. We always say you're tuning it, right? You're tuning the engine. You're tuning the device so that it works as efficiently as it should. And if you're not reading how the thing is supposed to actually work, well, you could have set your policy to none. I think even if you set it to nothing, it also just kind of like goes, okay, well, if you set it to nothing, that's the equivalent to none. And therefore, so if P equals like no string, then it will allow these things to come through. And again, that's going to really hurt you where you've set up a system to try to help. Now it's having the opposite effect. Now when the North Koreans, the Kim Sukis of the world, start sending spoofed emails, they have an air of legitimacy behind them. And people are like, oh, I don't have to worry about this. We have a machine that's stopping bad stuff. So if this could only be good.
Yep. And so the message from the Fed here is a valid message,
yeah.
Which is it's not enough to start implementing DMARC. You have to finish implementing DMARC. That's important if you want it to work.
And I don't like you anymore.
And just on a side note, I finally found it. The Samsung operating system was called Tizen.
Tizen.
Okay. That was to compete with Apple's Watch OS and Google's Wear OS. They wanted their own, and they were going to do TV appliances and all sorts of stuff with it.
Okay.
So there you go, Tizen.
There it is. Well, now, knowing it's half the battle, right? G.I. Joe.
Pork chop sandwiches.
Yeah, pork chop. So we still keep the pork chop sandwiches around for those special occasions because it does pop up from time to time. And speaking of segments, we now have to go to one of our favorite segments, which is Behind Bars.
Break the law and you'll go to jail.
That is the word on the street. Hopefully it happens more often than not. If you break the law, you go to jail. That's how it should work.
You go to jail, at least for a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Then you're left out on your own recognizance. Anywho, we got an article here about, this is from gbhackers.com, ex-security consultant jailed for trading confidential data. Man, this is the good old tale as old as time, the insider threats.
Yeah.
A person given access and trust to a system turned around and used that against their employers for nefarious purposes. Don, I hate to see it happen.
Yeah, you know, you can take every precaution you want. You can do background checks on contractors coming in. You can make them sign NDAs and engagement contracts and all that kind of stuff that you do with pen testers. You can do all of that, but there's still some bad apples out there. It's hard to sift them out sometimes.
Apparently, Vincent Kennedy is one of those bad actors. He's a professional who used to work as a consultant in the cybersecurity field, has been taken into custody for allegedly trying to extort a sum of money that could go up to $1.5 million from an IT company that is publicly traded. He said, yeah, I got your stuff. You want it back. I'm going to need that money.
This is it's reminiscent of the Ubiquity extortion thing where it was their CISO who was pretending to be a hacker and holding a ransom.
And then said, oh, this was a pen test.
Yeah.
That's not how pen tests work, buddy.
So, he's in jail. But in this case, he didn't even bother with the fake story. He was just like, look, I've got your data and you're going to pay me. And he wanted... He wanted a 10-year CD, a certificate of deposit.
He wanted to get interest on this thing.
Which is a weird thing to ask because CDs are traceable.
Listen, he's thinking of retirement, man. He's got...
There's got to be something
more
to this.
What's that high yield, right?
I mean, certainly.
He's thinking fiscally, man.
You know, all joking aside, now is the time to buy CDs.
Right, CDs are yielding good profits at this point in time, man. Forget your 401k. CDs are where it's at.
But normally...
We do not endorse any financial advice at the Technado, by the way.
That's right.
We're not financial experts.
No, far from it.
Man, I broke.
my fortune's in Dogecoin.
Yeah. It's going to pay.
But normally, when somebody's extorting a company, they want Bitcoin. They want something that they can at least try and obscure where the funds are going to and maintain some anonymity. In this case, wanted a CD. And that's just bizarre. So I have to imagine he's like mentally unstable or something.
Well, how do you, are we in the tech industry so odd to the rest of humanity that this dude flew by the radar? Because if he's mentally unstable and I just thought that was normal for IT workers, I mean, they might not be wrong because we're a weird group of people. I mean, I find it to be fun, but if it was the camouflage that got this guy his job and then he was like, no, now I steal all the things. I want some money. Where's my money? But this dude's facing down like the barrel of 20 years in jail for this. This was no joke. I mean, this is like a murder rap.
Yeah, worse than a murder rap in some states.
It's just depending, depending on which murder rap it is. Who did you kill? I mean, come on.
it's strange, but it just shows that oftentimes your biggest risk is the insider threat. It's people within your company.
Yep.
Or, I mean, this guy was a long-term contractor, but still, it's that somebody you've let in the door. They've got the key badge to get in, and it just shows how important it is to have separation of duties, to have peer review of work, to monitor audit logs. Like at some point, this guy had to exfiltrate that data, right?
Yeah, right.
And whatever method he used is probably not much different than whatever method a hacker would use. And so, that should have been monitored for, but not every company can do that.
Are we doing that here? Because, no, I'm asking for a friend.
So, if you take like this building.
Yeah.
No, because there's no PII stored here, right? So all of ours is stored up in
the cloud services. Yeah.
Right. And in the cloud services, yes, it is monitored for there.
Oh, man. Good to know.
It's actually easy to monitor for exfiltration in AWS because they bill for egress traffic.
You think I'll enjoy prison, Don?
But Salesforce, NetSuite, a lot of those tools that are out there, they have various monitoring for when somebody's pulling more records than they should. But user credentials should be restricted to small data sets. It gets tricky with security people, though.
Yeah.
If you take a security person and say, I want you to scan our network for vulnerabilities, but I'm going to restrict your access.
Right. You tied their hands.
Yeah.
Right. If they are security people, you have given them the keys to the devices that they can now tune to just ignore me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a difficult one. So do a lot of really, really good background checks and a couple of rounds of probably interviewing. Make sure you get the right person and then continuously monitor them.
Yep. And even then, know that you're going to miss stuff.
Yep.
Right.
It's no guarantee.
I mean, Edward Snowden, right?
Oh, yeah.
Dumped it to a USB key and walked out the door.
Walked out the door with it.
So you're not going to see that on your IPS.
No.
Yeah.
You got a hell of an IPS if you do. And I want to know where you got it.
And that was the NSA.
That was the NSA, right? The flipping NSA. Ah, fun stuff. Speaking of fun stuff, our next article comes to us from the Hacker News, one of our favorite haunts. Hackers increasingly abuse Microsoft Graph API for stealthy malware communications. This is the kind of thing that twirls my beanie. I really enjoy like C2 and all that red teamy stuff. It's really fun. I don't like it when hackers do it. I like it when we do it to try to figure out how they would do it. And this is a really crafty trick. It's not necessarily super novel. As far as maybe with them using Microsoft Graph API is something that's new, but we tend to try to find these open cloud services that have an API and then abuse the piss out of it.
Yeah, yeah. So for decades, if you wanted to stand up a command and control or C2 server, you'd use IRC. Right.
Yes.
Like, I mean, IRC was the go-to. There were IRC. You could just use EFNet, public IRC servers, and create your own channel on there. And there's your C2 network. That was the go-to. Well, I'm going to harp on IDS and IPS today. IDS and IPS devices, were tuned for that. They would look for IRC traffic. And most people don't use IRC in any meaningful way anymore. So companies would just block it out, right? And that was that. Now you can't talk to a C2 server. So hackers have had to get creative, and boy, have they. Like, they've come up with some really cool stuff. Yeah. And I remember talking about this a while back, where there was some malware. It was the first instance where it was using OneDrive as its C2 server. And so it could just, via the API, reach out to OneDrive and look for script files that it would pull down to execute. And the people controlling it could just change those script files in OneDrive, and then the bots would all connect. And if you're a network administrator, how do you filter for that? Here's a computer connecting to OneDrive.
Yeah.
It's encrypted because it's secure traffic. It's going to a Microsoft server.
It's a hacker's heaven, Don.
It really is. It really is. And how do you fight that?
That's a really good question. It's super difficult, right? Because like you said, it's all encrypted. Maybe with like a next-gen firewall where you're giving it keys and it's exchanging all that information with the next-gen firewall, it would be able to look into that information and see, oh, I don't really like what's going on here. And from there, but like you said, you would have to start doing that. You would have to then implement into those systems. And even if then, I'm not sure that it would be successful. That's why this has become kind of the popular way to go around getting your exfil traffic to go and your C2 traffic, is because you're giving me the platform to do this. So if you look at the Microsoft Graph API, what it allows you to do is to upload and download files from OneDrive. And OneDrive is a free service. Thanks, Microsoft. Right? Again, and I don't want to harp too bad on Microsoft. This isn't necessarily like a fault of theirs. You could do this with VirusTotal. I've literally looked at the VirusTotal API and went, oh, I can send like updates to VirusTotal. Like, so if I have an API to VirusTotal, I can do submissions through the API. In those submissions, I can send descriptions and updates. That could be command traffic. I could put my commands in base64 encoded strings and then pull it down with my malware. And I could be communicating through something that's supposed to help us. It's kind of a thing.
That would be the irony of it, right?
Right, like the VirusTotal. Yes, I was like, should I do this? Probably not, but man, I want to.
That'd be a cool thing to present at like one of the hacker conferences.
I guess I could, yeah.
Yeah, here's my C2 server.
Yeah, VirusTotal C2. VC2? How would I put that? I don't know. I have to come up with a name.
Yeah.
I'll build the tool. It'll be fun. I think I would be violating VirusTotal's terms and conditions.
I think that's
all
a given.
Over the place.
That's a given. Although, I mean, so do you have to log in to upload a file to VirusTotal? Because
no,
normally
you just have the API
hash.
Key. So you'd get an API key. So
you have to
you
log
just
in
make
to create
a SOC
an API
account.
Key.
Yeah.
Okay. So that would violate it. I'm thinking like there's probably some services out there where you don't have to log in, like Pastebin.
Right.
I do know
people
so
Pastebin
use Pastebin.
Was very popular. Yeah.
Yeah. As C2.
Yeah. So yeah, fun. good luck, Microsoft, and all you other free services that give us an API that which we can use. It's going to be a lot of, I'm assuming, looking at traffic and trying to figure out behavioral patterns. So hopefully, these next gen things can kind of figure that stuff out using AI and ML. And that's when you go to RSA, and that's they'll tell you that we can do that. And then you purchase it, and it doesn't really do that.
So you can protect against C2 by using AI at RSA. And
man, do we got enough acronyms for this? Acronym bingo here. Bingo! I got it. Right, this is fun. All right, let's see here. We got one more in the rapid fire, and let's see here. This one comes from securitynewspaper.com. I really scoured the internet for this one. But I'll be honest with you. I kind of looked at this site. It's not bad. I thought it was a good little place. I'll start haunting them. It says, how safe is your tiny proxy? Step-by-step guide to exploiting tiny proxy's zero-day vulnerability. So if you are running tiny proxy out there, I this is what I love about security news is I come in contact with software that I just did not know existed. Mm-hmm. But then you're like, oh, a lot of people are using this. I was unaware. Because it just kind of flies under the radar until one of these CVEs pops up that's like, oh, is it a 9.8? I believe this is a 9.8 out of 10 CVSS. So if you are running tiny proxy specific versions, Cisco Talos, their security research group, has discovered, rut-row, Raggy, we got a real problem because remote code execution is on the table.
Yeah, yep. And where this one gets even more risky is... If you haven't heard of tiny proxy, most people don't need proxies anymore, right? There was a short period of time back in the early 90s where proxies were really popular and they kind of went away. I guess some people use them for accessing Netflix from other countries and things like that, but VPNs have largely replaced that too. But one place where proxies are alive and well, Docker and any kind of container environment, right? So if you use Docker Compose and you start spinning up a bunch of containers on your system and you need to publish a port for systems to access, Docker will, you might have five containers that all need the same port and that's going to conflict, right? So you got to pick different ports. And then you've got to have some way to direct traffic to the IP on the host to these individual containers that likely don't have public IPs or even network IPs. They probably just have internal to the Docker environment. And so that's where a proxy comes in. The other thing is if you want SSL, if you want, or TLS, whatever you're using today, hopefully,
hopefully TLS.
So if
Don's still on SSL V1, maybe.
It's hard. It's like bringing it back for so long. I know. And then you got to change. But so if you've got to generate a certificate and you've got 50 containers, you don't want to have to go and plug that certificate into all 50 containers. That's a nightmare, right? And you want to be able to easily change the certificate. And so oftentimes, what developers will do is set it up where the TLS connection terminates on the proxy, and then it just uses regular HTTP to the containers on the back end, right? It's the back end, totally safe.
We're in the safe zone.
Right.
We made it past. That's kind of the janky thing about proxies and things of that nature is they sit in the DMZ. They're facing the public-facing internet as well as your internal-facing network, and they kind of act as a gateway from one network to the next, right?
Yep. Now, fun fact, if you're filling out a security questionnaire for compliance and they ask if your data is encrypted in transit end to end and you're terminating your secure connection on a proxy, you are no longer encrypted end to end.
Right.
You're encrypted across the public network, sure. But once you get to your internal network, it's now moving between devices unencrypted. And why is that a problem? Because of stuff like this. If the attacker can take over tiny proxy, right? They can now see the unencrypted backend as well as the certificate. It's right there, and you've effectively popped network security for your environment.
Yeah, that's a real problem. It was funny, we were talking about this article because it was kind of like a last minute throw in. And Don was like, well, it's who's using proxies anymore? And that's true, right? We came up with the idea of where they're being used. But then you were like, but it's a proxy. Big deal. And I'm like, well, it's actually a really good spot to kind of nestle in as an attacker because who's logging into the proxy? Who's watching the proxy? If the proxy's doing proxy stuff and no one's complaining, just kind of sits there and now it becomes a really good pivot point.
Yeah.
For I can use it to bring all the data into that and then exfil out from the proxy and now all that's encrypted. You start to see the fun times that can be had because I'm now got a really good place to laterally move throughout the network that's completely trusted. And it's a lot of fun for hackers. So definitely. If you have TinyProxy installed, you're going to want to do some updating. I think they did release an update, if I'm not mistaken.
They did.
Yeah, there you go. So if you're interested, this article does have a step-by-step for doing exploitation. So if you're just interested in that kind of stuff, if you're wondering, am I vulnerable? Well, you know, check those versions, and then have some fun and install it yourself and see how that all works, since you know exactly what that attack vector looks like. All right, Don, rapid fire has been rapidly fired. We've gone through a lot of articles, but we're going to take a little break, take a breath, stretch our legs. We'll come back. We got the deep dive. We're going to get into a little bit of Mac OS malware. This ought to be a little bit of fun for us. So stay tuned for that. And until we come back, watch this commercial.
Tired of trying to schedule your team's time around in-person learning? Isn't it a bummer to spend thousands of dollars on travel for professional development? What if we said you can save money and time and still provide your team with the best training possible? The answer to your woes is live online training from ACI Learning. With live online training, we provide our top in-person courses in private, online, instructor-led formats. You get to provide professional development in a manner that fits today's expectations. Entertaining, convenient, and effective. Our exam-aligned courses inspire the full potential of your team. Visit virtual instructor-led training at ACI Learning for more info.
Well, that was an amazing commercial. I'm sure it changed your life. Hopefully it did. Now that lives have been changed, let's change them even more and go into our deep dive section here on the TechNado. It's one of my favorite sections because what Don was like, tell me a little bit about this deep dive thing you guys are doing. I'm like, it's just a chance for us to nerd out on some technology, some security stuff. And I really enjoy looking at malware and seeing how malware works because I'm really interested in red teaming things. And you have to kind of develop and use malware for those purposes. But it does give us a better look at our systems, the attack vectors that they are vulnerable to, and how threats that are out there are capitalizing on these things. And for us to know those systems better is going to make us better at our jobs at securing them. At least hopefully that's the idea anyway. And today is a really interesting one because I don't think we've ever talked about Mac malware.
Because it doesn't exist, Daniel.
I know. I had it on good authority that Mac malware was not a thing. But lo and behold, damned if I didn't find me some.
Sure, the date on this article is on April 1st.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's Oh, they got me. They got me, dang, man. Well, this comes from kanji.io, and this is Malware Cuckoo. I don't name these things. Behaves like a cross between InfoStealer and spyware. So it's kind of double dipping on the what it actually does. And what's interesting, they said that they named it Cuckoo because there's a bird called the cuckoo bird, and it lays its eggs in the nests of other birds and steals the host's resources for the gain of its young. So in the same vein as the cuckoo bird, the cuckoo malware nests itself into your Mac operating system and steals information and does a little spying while it's there. It's a lot of fun. Not for anyone that actually is going through this, but for us to investigate.
Now, if you're like me, maybe a little more of a novice than Daniel, I thought, what the hell is the difference between an InfoStealer and malware? I mean, spyware.
Yeah.
You know, they're both kind of do the same thing, but it really boils down to persistence, right?
Persistence is the thing.
An InfoStealer just wants to get in there, get your data, get out, but spyware wants to hang around. This one does both.
This one's like, hey, why can't I live in both of those worlds?
Like Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
That's exactly right. They put the chocolate and peanut butter together, and everybody was happy on whoever these threat actors are that are doing this. But they said that, I love this part. I said, how do they find it? Because I'm really interested in how do security researchers discover new malware variants and things of that nature? They set up honeypots, mm-hmm. and then they watch it as it rolls in and go, oh, what's this? Now, they said that they found this one. It was named, it was actually from VirusTotal. So there was this dump media Spotify media converter, and it was put on VirusTotal on April the 24th. And it was also found under the name UPD. This is a universal binary that can run on ARM-based Macs or Intel-based Macs. Now, if you're not familiar with Macs too much, MacOs are the binary format. So you got EXEs over in Windows worlds, you got ELF binaries over in Linux land, and you got MacOs that are in...
I don't want to be too pedantic.
I know, you're getting ready to get onto me here.
It's Mach-O.
Is it?
Because it's the Mach kernel. M-A-C-H.
Right. Yeah, I always say Macho. Yeah,
deep down underside.
He actually used to call it Macho because it was more fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Snap into a Slim Jim.
Yeah. You can have the Macho.
We just watched Idiocracy the other day with President Camacho.
Did you really? Oh, it's a good flick. Good flick. Shame we're living in it. But you know what that comes from is I've never heard anybody say it out loud. I've only ever read it.
Yeah. So you know how a lot of people say that macOS is basically BSD?
Yes.
BSD Unix?
Yeah.
It sort of is, but the Darwin kernel underneath it is based on the mock kernel. And so the kind of template OS in the early days was, I don't know, mock whatever. So the binaries are mock-o.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
There you go.
Pronunciation.
Fun facts. I'm being pedantic. And we got to use the word pedantic today, which is fun for us.
Yeah, biggest word I'll use today.
Yes, yes. So this is really interesting. So basically their initial access vector, right? It's what we like to call it in the biz. How did they get initial access? Well, they tricked people. They said, hey, come and download this Spotify Media Converter tool. It's going to save your life. What does the tool do? Well, you go to Spotify, you stream something, and we can rip that into an MP3.
I can't tell you how many times over the years, and I'm being serious,
yeah,
where I needed to convert like an AVI to an MP4 or AAC to an MP3, like, you know, and I would just do a quick Google search and you'd get all these like shady companies that would show up on the top of the list, you know, so-and-so media converter and so on.
Yeah.
And every now and then you'd find an open source one. And I would usually try and go with the open source one. There's at least some verification
scrutiny
there.
Yeah.
But there were tons of other products that you'd never heard of.
Yep.
And I could totally see people saying, you know what? Let me just try it. And I just need it one time. I'll use the demo, the trial,
yep,
install that, do what I want, never run the program again.
Yep. And that's exactly what happens. Every once in a while, kind of like Don, you find yourself in that position where you're like, I need this tool that could do X, Y, or Z. It seems kind of niche and weird, but in today's world, I need that.
Mm-hmm.
So you do your Google search, you find these things, and people will see these and go, that looks legit. And what's funny is this is actually legit software. So the malware is actually bundled in the legit media converter.
So it's
it will run
chain.
And do it. Yes. Well, yeah, in a way, right? So you're not getting it straight from the manufacturer. They set up fake infrastructure
look
like,
okay.
Yes. You basically just take the binary and then you bundle in your malware. You decompile it, you bundle your malware in, you add it to that compilation, you recompile it back together, and then I give it to you. I run and it actually does Spotify media conversions.
You know, fun fact,
yeah,
with the way that Mac binaries are packaged, right? Mm. So, and I think the article talks about the way they do bundles.
Yeah.
If you're not a Mac user, right, it's a different world than Windows and Linux. So in Windows and Linux, when you install an app, there's an executable somewhere. There's a binary file.
Right.
But there's also a ton of library files and other stuff that goes along with it that's necessary to make the app work. But in the Mac world, there's just one file. In one file. And when you install an app, you know, like you download this file, it'll say just drag and drop it your application folder and that's
done.
And the reason is they use these bundle files and they don't go right out and tell you this, but if you take the bundle file and just add .zip to the end of it, it's just a zip archive.
Yeah.
And then you can open it right up. You can do this on Windows, Linux, whatever, and you can open it right up and look. So you don't even have to recompile it to add malware to it.
Right. Because you're just adding it to the bundle. So,
yeah.
And it's funny you bring this up because if we take a look at my screen here, we can see that one of the major, like, what's going on? It's a little different. To Don's point, you'll notice that it doesn't say drag to applications. It says right-click. This is the actual installer, a view of them running the installer. It says right-click on the icon below and click open.
That is different.
That is not normal. Now, why are they saying to do this? Because the way this works is it will get popped because as Don's point goes to, it's just a bundle of files. If you do that show package contents instead and see what's actually in this, you'll notice that there are some things that should not be there that are going to get run. And since you're downloading from an unreliable source, what does Mac operating system do when you download things that get installed and run as executables? It goes, hey, I don't know what this is. You need to approve that this is going to be done. So this is kind of like cutting that off at the pass and going, hey, just right click, go open. You're basically telling the system, I know what this is. I want to run it instead of trying to just double click it.
Yep. And unfortunately, as a side effect of Apple's App Store policies, if you install an app from the App Store, you don't get the, it's called Gatekeeper. You don't get the Gatekeeper trigger. But if you download an app from anywhere else on the entire planet, you get a Gatekeeper pop-up. And so people are used to that. When they install an app not from the App Store, they're expecting you to get a dialog box of some sort and to say okay to it, right? And even if it asks for admin credentials, people are used to that too. Like, oh, maybe it has to write somewhere outside of my user folder. Then it's going to prompt for that. And so people provide that, and that gives this malware the chance to get elevated privileges.
Yep. So back to our story. Interesting stuff here, right? I do love learning this. Like I said, this is what I like, this, the nerding out part of learning about the Mac operating system and how we can abuse some of the way it's supposed to work for nefarious purposes so that we can know more about that. So it says when we selected the show package contents instead of open, they found and then navigated the macOS folder with the bundle, found the Mako binary called UPD. This is the actual malware itself. And that name raised red flags to them as well, because normally when you download a binary for the Mac operating system, the binary is the name of the package. We go, oh, if I'm, you know, Dan's Media Converter, it will be Dan's Media Converter.exe or whatever. It'll be the same as the thing you downloaded. This was not the case. It was some weird just UPD name. And that name raised the red flags for them. So not only that, they saw also looking at the UPD file in the original bundle, we found that it was signed ad hoc with no developer ID. That right there is just like warning, Will Robinson, because Apple is extremely, what's the word, stringent, right? They're strict about applications going through the right process to be released. Now, obviously, you can dev for the environment if you want to, but if I don't have an Apple developer ID assigned to us, you can't trace it back to me.
Right. And, you know, they used to be strict about if you had an Apple developer ID, you could sign an app, but it had to be available via the App Store. And developers were frustrated because if they didn't want to use the App Store, they couldn't sign their apps. But Apple changed that policy. So it cost a developer $99 a year if they want to be able to sign their apps. That's not a big deal, even for a small shop like a somebody who creates some shareware or whatever, not a big deal for them to sign it. So in this day and age, you really shouldn't have unsigned apps.
No, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. All right, now let's talk about running this application. Let's get into what happens. Okay, I've done the bad thing. I've downloaded this. I've right-clicked and hit open like a fool. But hey, you got me. What are you going to do? It was a good fish. And it says, running the application, once we allowed the application to run, we could see from a process monitor that it spawned a bash shell. And it uses this system profiler system. You can just see right here, simple sh-c, which basically means run this in the bash or in the shell of your system, to grab this system profiler device and give me the SP hardware data type. Then they run it through awk to kind of pare down to only the specific things that they are looking for from this. And you can run this on your computer. There's nothing nefarious about this specific command. I did it on mine. It just starts pulling back a bunch of information. And this kind of gets to what it's doing. It's gathering the hardware UUID in this initial stage. So it wants to grab that UUID probably for the purposes of, this is a different system than the other system that I've popped.
Yeah, and it's starting the info stealer process, right?
Correct.
So gathering that data and exfiltrating it.
That's right. And of course, they're doing what all good hackers do, which is doing some sort of encryption or encoding or both. And in this instance, they're using Zor encryption. They say Zor encoded. I've always heard it as Zor encryption. And this is basically the idea of we are going to look at, we're going to run it through a filter. You create a symmetrical key, which can be anything you want. You can say, you know, my key if you like. But randomness is always usually better. And if you have similar, I'll see if I can remember Zor encoding. I'm sure Don knows this off the top of his head. But it's if it's the same, it comes out as a 1. If it's different, it comes out as a 0. I typically get those backwards, so fact check me on that.
I don't recall.
Don's pleading the fifth on this one.
This is where I would Google it.
Either way, it just kind of runs it through a little filter and then modifies with the output. And then the encryption key helps to reverse that case. Ultimately, what they're trying to do is just obfuscate this from the system. So any monitoring that would be running and looking to see what is this doing, it wouldn't easily be able to do that or be able to do that at all. Once you have it all encoded or encrypted, then, of course, that is how they're going to run all the commands that they work in this. So we're going to see Zor encoding, as they say here. I'll use their terminology. They're going to Zor encode every command that they throw at the system. So they do show this in kind of the what looks like and maybe this is how MACOs are coded. I'm not familiar with how to do that for those systems, but it looks a lot like assembly to me, because you see some hex values and that kind of thing, and you do see some interesting things that might tell you what's going on here. They do kind of point to registers in the CPU and things of that nature. Are you familiar with any of this, Don?
Yeah, so a lot of it is written in C.
Yeah, okay.
And so in C, you have to do, like, you have to specify memory addresses as opposed to, like, variable names and
correct.
Things. I mean, you can map addresses to variable names.
It's really hard.
Yeah. But for these guys, because they're having to reverse engineer it, that's what they see. And so that's what they're providing.
That makes sense.
I'm not familiar with Kanji.io, but they did a really good breakdown on this.
They did a phenomenal breakdown on this. So great job out there. Your team is doing a phenomenal work, and we thank you for your efforts. But really, really cool stuff, how basically showing you how they got to from here to here. So this stuff right here, all this wondrousness turns into this on the other end. A lot of fun. So reverse engineering, it's not just for dinner anymore, Don.
Yeah, because you can pull the data right out of memory, but if it's obfuscated like this is, you've got to figure out how to deobfuscate, and that's the challenge.
And they're looking for the Zor encryption key, which typically is bundled into that. And if they find that, it's good. I used to think, well, if you're putting the encryption key into the malware itself, I mean, what are you really hiding from? You're hiding from the machine. The machine doesn't know what to do with that other than decrypt whatever is encrypted, or encrypt whatever needs to be encrypted, because that's what the commands tell it to do. It doesn't care what's going on.
And they get an extra advantage in that most Macs aren't running any kind of host-based antivirus.
Because there's no malware for Macs, Don.
Yeah.
What do you need it for?
That's true.
That's ridiculous. Stop being ridiculous, okay? All right, moving on. Let's keep going here. Let's see. They got a decoding loop. That's always fun. So it's just kind of more of that breakdown. Definitely, we probably spend 3 hours on this entire breakdown if we really got into the nuts and bolts of it. Yep. But basically telling you, now this is an interesting thing where it says once the string is decoded, it passes to a function that calls popen, which is a very common function for executing a string, or like a command execution. So if you see open, popen, exec, that kind of thing, that's usually for, hey, I need you to run this for me. Why don't you go ahead and do that? It'd be great. I appreciate it. So that's what they do. They use popen for that. Anything else cool that goes around here? It does say that the original UPD will then use the xadder-d command to remove the quarantine flag from itself. Probably has that enabled. And now it can remove that to be like, now I'm free to move about the cabin.
Yep. On a Mac, you might try and open a downloaded binary, and it'll tell you, you'll get a warning that'll say, this executable originated from the internet. Are you sure you want to open it?
Yeah.
Right. And that's the quarantine feature. And if you remove that, all of a sudden it says it's not from the internet, right? That it came from somewhere else. It came from a USB key or an install media. So that's what they're changing.
That's
there.
Right. All right. Now it does a locale check. Really interesting little piece of this software. Kind of probably going to give us some ideas into attribution.
This is showing up a lot in malware today.
Look at Don staying on top of things. He acts like he's busy running companies. He's really just nerding out at his house, not doing a dang thing.
It's the fun part of the job, you know?
Eating vines and stuff.
I think it's fun coming up with a budget.
Getting sock toque. No, it's not. It's not at all.
No.
You're wondering what the answer to that question was. The answer is it's not fun. Zero fun, sir. So the locale check, this basically what it does is it looks at the lang environmental variable in the shell to say, hey, where you at? What you doing? Right now, I could use IP or something, but it goes with language on this, which is probably a bit more, it's going to be, what's the word I'm looking for, Don? Help me out here.
So it's going to be more accurate.
Accurate. Thank you. Yes.
And the reasoning for that is, like, let's say you I don't want to let the cat out of the bag here, but let's say you live in Russia, right? And they've got they've got their own firewall up just like China does.
Right.
And so if you're in Russia and you're an attacker or whatever, you're likely VPNing out of the country. And so they can't rely on your IP or geolocation because you'd show up in a different place. But if they look at what your keyboard is set to or what your currency value is set to and they see that.
Because it's unlikely that many people in the States or the EU are speaking Russian. Because that's just not what we do. It's just English is typically, well, in Great Britain and things of that nature. But that just goes to show you that's who they're looking for. And they're not looking for, as we can see, if we look here, it's got a laundry list of different, let me scroll down here. There we go.
The usual suspects.
They want to avoid the countries of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Russia, and Ukraine, which I found interesting because Russia and Ukraine are kind of in conflict with each other right now, if you hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
But they are avoiding those two countries. So could this be Ukrainian? Could this be Russian? Most likely Russian, I would think.
Yeah, you have to remember, like, criminal organizations don't necessarily observe governmental boundaries.
Yeah.
And, you really got to go back to USSR days, right? Estonia, Belarus, Latvia, like, all of those countries were either part of Russia or were satellite countries, you know, that were attached to the USSR. And so the criminal organizations that you face today are really the same ones that were around back then. And so even though Russia and Ukraine are at war right now, there are absolutely criminal gangs that have footholds in both countries.
So this could just be a criminal organization and not necessarily like a nation state APT or something.
It could be.
Yeah,
could
that's
be.
A good point.
And I don't like to jump straight to this is a state-sponsored whatever, but...
Even though it typically is.
It typically is, yeah.
Well, it is either some sort of like ransomware group or... Yeah. Yeah.
But this has happened so much that some security researchers out there actually recommend you add the Russian keyboard as an option on your system, even if you never activate it, just to have it.
Yep.
And
it's fun to trick the baddies out there, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, your machine still gets infected.
It does.
Right? It just.
So to the point, right? This machine, let's say that I had the Russian language enabled and it said, oh, hey, look, it's a Russian, it's a fellow Ruski or whatever. I'm not going to run malicious stuff. It's not going to do info stealing and spywaring. What it does do is give me the option to use the media stream converter.
Yeah.
So it does none of the bad stuff and just gives you all the functionality you were actually looking for.
Yep.
So, you know, joke's on them. I set my stuff to Russian and now I got a great media converter for my Spotify. Ha ha ha.
You know, actually, after having gone through all this, I still don't know if the thing is a great media converter.
Right, that's
it
true.
Totally
I actually used it. they used the jankiest one on the market. It's like, oh, it sucks. I'm uninstalling this. But now we come to persistence, because Don mentioned persistence. Yep. This is where it kind of separates the stealerware from malware or spyware, as it were. And to create persistence is always a fun thing. It says, stealers do not typically set persistence. That behavior is more usual in spyware. So it is surprising to see that this malware does it. Each of the strings needed to create and then populate a plist. And man, I hate plists. It's basically the
pain in the butt.
It's basically the crappiest cron capability. Like, they used to have cron, and then they got rid of cron and they brought in this plist crap. It's spent me like 3 hours trying to figure out how to make a scheduled task on my Mac OS one night.
Yeah. You know, plist files originally were like Mac's answer to the Windows registry, right? Mm. So the Windows registry, you got this one big hive where you can have all sorts of values and key value registers, right? In Mac OS, you had plist files that could store all sorts of system preferences and things, but now they use it for a lot more. And replacing cron job functionality is actually how I learned about plist.
Me too.
Launch agents in general.
Oh, gotcha.
And I think it was like Mac OS 10 point, it was still called Mac OS 10 back then, 10.6 or 7 or whatever, where they made that change. And so if you wanted an application to run at boot time, so prior to login, if it's post-login, you can just go into your user account. You've got a setting there where you can add launch apps and that's that. But if you want something to run pre-login, or if you want it to run on a set schedule, you've got to go and create a launch agent and define a plist that says, you know, what the schedule is for it to run. It's a pain in the butt, but it's stored in a text file, and that means it's easy for malware to recreate, which is exactly what we're seeing here.
That's right. It creates that plist, slaps it in a very specific area of your device, and then if we take a look here, we can see that it uses the launch CTL to persistently load a launch agent for a plist from the application, and there's the command that does that. And then looking into the plist, we see that the goal is to run every 60 seconds. So every 60 seconds, this thing is trying to run and make sure that it is doing its thing, doing all the steely stuff and spying stuff that it does. persistence is set up with calls to the XOR function, again, more XOR, to decode the strings, and then uses SNN printf. And this is kind of just kind of getting into how it's doing that. So if you're interested in that, definitely dive a little more deep, because they, like we've said before, it definitely does that into this. But once that persistence is set up, now we got to move into some priv-esc, because that is super helpful for us. So from here, the UPD uses OSA script to ask the user for their password. I thought this was like super crafty, right? It says, hey, macOS needs access to system settings. How often do you get that prompt if you run a macOS? I constantly get that thing. Hey, you need to type in your password to do X, Y, or Z.
It's funny to me. Like, what's the easiest way to get a user's password? Ask them for it.
Ask them for it. Yeah. Hey, can I have your password? Well, hell yeah, yeah. You can. Let me just...
and again, people are used to this. Hey, I'm installing an application.
Yep.
And it's going to ask my password. It must be writing files to somewhere important. There you go.
What could go wrong here, Don?
Yeah, yeah. But the way it described generating the... I didn't actually get to see what the prompt looked like for the password. Do they have a picture?
No, I don't think they did. I think they
The way they described it, it sounded to me like it would look different than the normal pop-up, but gotcha. I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't see it either. But definitely a crafty piece of tradecraft that they got going on there. It's just, like Don said, let me just give you something that looks official and ask you for your password. And a lot of people, probably 9 out of 10, would probably do that thing easily without even hesitation.
People are on their guard for phishing emails, right? If you send somebody an email asking for their password, they've learned not to mess with that. But if it's an application asking for the password,
that looks like it's coming from the operating system.
And they're in the process of installing an app. Oh, people fall for that.
Yeah, perfect storm.
All day long.
Yeah. I would probably fall for that, right? If I had to download this thing because I was an idiot and I'm out there looking for Spotify media converters.
I got to see if I can see the icon on desktop.
Pay no attention, Don. This is not for you. Keep your eyes on your own stuff, okay? But yeah, I totally would have got hit with this and not thought twice about it because it is a very crafty thing. So then they save the password file into a file called PW, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's just called PW. There it is. Written to the PW.dat file, as mentioned above. All right. They make a little copy of that, and then they start sending that kind of information to C2. I think that's where we get into C2's traffic. It runs into spying and info stealing, which probably forgot about that part. Is it does do some spying and info stealing specifically. What is it stealing? A ton of stuff, like a lot of things. If we look at the list,
this is the best part of the article, because to me, it shows you the type of thing these attackers are looking for.
Right.
You know,
started off with system information. So just like a PS, like what applications are running on your device. It looks for that. What are the installed applications? I want to say it looks. Oh, here we go. Here's a little laundry list. We got browser setup. So it's looking for stuff in Safari, FileZilla, Steam query. So the Steam, right?
Yep.
You're running Steam, wallets and coins. Yay. So if you're running Bitcoin, that's fun. Discord, Telegram, ZSH, SSH, curl setup. Now, Don, you said something about ZSH. Now, I thought it was super pertinent.
Yeah.
Please explain why ZSH is going to hamstring you here.
So this article is kind of a living one. They keep adding more targets to it. And one of the last ones they added, I was surprised it was the last, because it's an attack vector that I know about.
Yeah.
In macOS, when you open up a terminal, the default shell for it is ZSH. And ZSH maintains a command history. Now, Bash does the same thing, so it really doesn't matter what your terminal is. They maintain a command history. Well, if you're a developer and you've used a tool like the AWS console or the AWS command line client, which almost every AWS developer uses, well, you have likely had to input your API key into the AWS client so that it functions. And when I say you're likely to have done it, I mean, you've done it.
You've absolutely done that.
And unless you have intentionally cleared your ZSH history, the odds are your API key is still in your history. ZSH maintains a pretty big history file. Mm. And so if they can harvest that, anything you've entered in the command line is going to be in there. So anytime you've passed a credential for a one-time operation, anytime you've done a token, anything that you've executed historically, it's right there. And they can get it. It's all in that history file. It's just a simple text file, easy to exfiltrate. Your user has full permission to it. You're the user who's executing this stuff. So like they don't even have to elevate creds to get at it.
Dude, when I'm doing any kind of like pen testing or CTFs or things of that nature, if I make access into a Linux system, it's one of the first things I do is go check for bash history, right?
Yeah.
Or the history file. Or just start pushing up and see what happens there if I have that kind of access to the system. So You'll see a lot of people, and especially in CTFs, they'll just redirect all bash history to dev null, and because I want to keep that, or set hist to zero. Yeah. You know, it's just so they're not maintaining that history file, because there's a lot of good stuff that people type into there. They're bash prompts.
But it's a pain. I use the hell out of my history.
I know. It's super useful. So, but there it is, right? If it's ease of use, it's typically probably going to give you some vulnerability there.
And there are ways around it. So like when I set up my AWS client, I create a credential file first.
Yeah.
And then I edit that file and I put the credential in there. And then the AWS client just points to the file. Mm. But hey, if the attacker gets the history, they know where that file is. They're already in. Yeah. They can get at that file too. Yeah. So that's a challenge that you've got to keep. Yeah,
the good thing about that is if you're doing something, you're making, you know, something like Vagrant or doing Puppet or Chef or any kind of orchestration, and you're just calling from a file, you're not actually putting those things inside the code that you might be hosting in GitHub or that kind of stuff. So you want to keep those things out of there. I typically will use an environmental variable to hold my API key and then just call the environmental variable for that stuff.
I know a developer who will remain unnamed who wanted to make it easy to move between computers. And so he set up a GitHub repository to synchronize his user profile. What he wanted was every time he dropped to the terminal, he wanted to have the same aliases and stuff like that in place. And so the bash RC file or whatever ZSH uses would be synced. Well, it was ZSH, and he synced that up, and his AWS key was in there. And GitHub actually scours the repositories.
I'm thinking of the meme right now of Leonardo DiCaprio on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Where there it is.
Holding the beer and the cigarette.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I get an email from GitHub because I was the AWS administrator back then. And I get an email from AWS. GitHub. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm jumping companies now.
You're good.
I get an email from GitHub saying, hey, your API key or an API key has been posted here. You need to do something about it.
Yeah.
And so it was cool because we took action really fast. But for a few minutes, that developer's API key was exposed. And so we had to kill off that API key and rotate it and so on. But if GitHub hadn't sent me that warning, I wouldn't have known.
Well, we'd have been host.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Fun stuff. Fun stuff, kids. All right. Basically, the rest of the article is some of the other things that it does info stealing on. Obviously, I think I already talked about it's looking for data from third-party applications and how they're collecting that. App data collection, so stealing from Safari, the keychain, notes, always great places to start looking if you are a nefarious actor. So you're using Safari's query. They're also using keychains as well to look in those and notes as well. So these are just basically part of the APIs of the operating system.
I thought it was interesting that it scours the file system for certain file extensions. And some of those are pretty important, like OVPN, which is OpenVPN profiles. Yeah.
Yep.
So you can load one of those in. It's got all your creds in it, ready to go. PEM files, which would be your private keys for SSH sessions. There was another one that stood out as being a big deal. JPEGs.
You gotta have those JPEGs, man.
PDFs, you know, just all the other stuff that you'd think about. It's interesting what they search for.
Yeah, absolutely. And then from there, they also do screen captures. You don't want to have malware without screen capture microphone capabilities. I think they grab that as well.
And that's persistent too. Like it runs. The microphone one, wasn't there something?
Did it have a microphone?
Yeah, it was on there, but it was for a tricky reason. They wanted to
was
do
it for,
something.
Like, voice recognition or something?
So on a Mac, when you take a screen capture, it makes a noise.
Oh,
it makes like a camera click sound. And so it requests microphone and speaker privileges, and it will mute the system, take the screenshot, unmute the system.
Gotcha.
And so like they thought through it enough to make it where the user won't notice the screenshot happening. And that's why a lot of operating systems have changed. I don't know if you've noticed this recently, but you take a screenshot and the whole screen kind of flashes.
Yeah.
And that's why it's letting you know as the user that that just happened. So if a program does it, I don't know if Macs do it or not. I know Windows does.
Yeah, I've definitely heard a Mac do it because I take screenshots all the time. So you're that
does
little...
the screen flash?
It does kind of like a
okay.
Thing.
All right. Yeah. So I mean that's supposed to counteract and make it where you don't know that's happening or that you do know that's happening.
Yeah. And even if it did happen, most people are probably like, that's weird.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Computers computing. What are you gonna do, right?
Glitch in the matrix.
Yeah. So interesting fact about it, C2 is it's using curl, just straight up curl for C2 communications, which is simple and effective, right? Because you're just grabbing URLs and probably doing some post and get, and you're good to go. It's fairly simple. I've built janky little C2s that basically do the exact same thing,
yeah.
where you just say, hey, post this information from the malware to the C2 server, which is running, you know, Apache or Nginx or something. And then once that information is there, the system can then run, get so it's basically kind of posting. So if it ran a command, say cat etsy password, right, runs that command, grabs that data, and then posts it to, does a post request to the Apache server. And now that's in the logs, and I can skim the logs and grab that information.
Yeah.
So that's basically what's kind of happening here.
The only problem with that method is that you have to basically hard code an IP or domain name
for
curl to access. And so when you hear about the FBI doing a takedown or seizing a domain, that's usually what they're doing, is trying to seize whatever the C2 URL is. In this case, it looks like it was hard coded to an IP address. So yep. Now that the authorities are aware of it, at some point that IP address will get seized, which will break current installs, but they just change the IP in the binary and new
yep,
people get hit.
It moves on. They just keep playing this whack-a-mole game. It's
yeah.
the fun cat and mouse that we do. And of course, speaking of indicators of compromise, we've got a whole laundry list of indicators of compromise. So if you need to check your systems and make sure that you don't have any of this action happening, you can, of course, start whipping up your Yara and Sigma rules. Till the day's end, there's the DMG. So grab that Spotify music converter. That's a SHA, looks like 256 maybe hash value of these. We got the, what is it again? Makos. The Makos SHA hash values for those. And then those domains and IPs. So you can set those in your firewalls and say, we don't talk to these people. They are persona non grata. So, and as Don said, there's the addendum of the deep dive. They just kept adding the functionality that they were discovering into the feature in the addendum. So check that out at your leisure. We are out of time for this episode, Don. We have run it down to the nub. It's been a lot of fun, though. Been really enjoyed having you back. How was it being back?
It's good. You know, yeah. Just snap right back into it. So
we'll have to make scheduled appointments for you to be back in the hot seat.
Yeah, I'll be around.
All right. That said, we're going to leave you, but don't forget to check out all the things that our parent organization, ACI, our sponsors, that they're doing over at ACI.com, right? ACILearning.com. That's the official website. We also have the TechNado website. Check that out. Join us here on the YouTubes. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Leave us a comment. We like to hear what you have to say about these things. Always interested in hearing your thoughts and opinions on the articles that we went through, as well as if you have some suggestions for articles, totally down with that. Actually, one of the articles today was suggested to me in LinkedIn by one of our viewers.
Awesome.
Like, hey, cool. I was like, it was the DKIM one. I was like, absolutely, we're using this one. This is a great article.
Yeah.
So love to hear that stuff. That said, Don, again, thanks for joining us. Thank you for watching. And until next time, take it easy.
Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed today's show, consider subscribing so you'll never miss a new episode.